Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother story time. This week, we bring you the next three stories from Winesburg, Ohio: Godliness Part 4, A Man of Ideas, and Adventure. We continue wading further into the many characters of the town. In these three stories, I feel the innocence of the characters, sometimes sad and tragic, sometimes fanciful and fun. I hope you are enjoying the series as much as I am. And now, Godliness Part 4, Terror, concerning David Hardy. When David Hardy was a tall boy of 15, he, like his mother, had an adventure that changed the whole current of his life and sent him out of his quiet corner into the world. The shell of the circumstances of his life was broken, and he was compelled to start forth. He left Winesburg, and no one there ever saw him again. After his disappearance, his mother and grandfather both died, and his father became very rich. He spent much money in trying to locate his son, but that is no part of this story. It was in the late fall of an unusual year on the Bentley farms. Everywhere the crops had been heavy. That spring, Jess had bought part of a long strip of black swampland that lay in the valley of Wine Creek. He got the land at a low price, but had spent a large sum of money to improve it. Great ditches had to be dug, and thousands of tile laid. Neighboring farmers shook their heads over the expense. Some of them laughed and hoped that Jess would lose heavily by the venture. But the old man went silently on with the work and said nothing. When the land was drained, he planted it to cabbages and onions, and again the neighbors laughed. The crop was, however, enormous and brought high prices. In 1 year, Jess made enough money to pay for all the cost of preparing the land and had a surplus that enabled him to buy 2 more farms. He was exultant and could not conceal his delight. For the first time in all the history of his ownership of the farms, he went among his men with a smiling face. Jess bought a great many new machines for cutting down the cost of labor and all of the remaining acres in the strip of black fertile swampland. One day he went into Winesburg and bought a bicycle and a new suit of clothes for David, and he gave his 2 sisters money with which to go to a religious convention at Cleveland, Ohio. In the fall of that year, when the frost came and the trees in the forests along Wine Creek were golden brown, David spent every moment when he did not have to attend school out in the open. Alone or with other boys, he went every afternoon into the woods to gather nuts. The other boys of the countryside, most of them sons of laborers on the Bentley farms, had guns with which they went hunting rabbits and squirrels. But David did not go with them. He made himself a sling with rubber bands and a forked stick and went off by himself to gather nuts. As he went about, thoughts came to him. He realized that he was almost a man and wondered what he would do in life. But before they came to anything, the thoughts passed and he was a boy again. One day, he killed a squirrel that sat on one of the lower branches of the tree and chattered at him. Home he ran with the squirrel in his hand. One of the Bentley sisters cooked the little animal, and he ate it with great gusto. The skin he tacked on a board and suspended the board by a string from his bedroom window. This gave his mind a new turn. After that, he never went into the woods without carrying the sling in his pocket, and he spent hours shooting at imaginary animals concealed among the brown leaves in the trees. Thoughts of his coming manhood passed, and he was content to be a boy, with a boy's impulses. One Saturday morning, when he was about to set off for the woods with the sling in his pocket and a bag for nuts on his shoulder, his grandfather stopped him. In the eyes of the old man was the strained, serious look that always a little frightened David. At such times, Jess Bentley's eyes did not look straight ahead, but wavered and seemed to be looking at nothing. Something like an invisible curtain appeared to have come between the man and all the rest of the world.
I want you to come with me, he said briefly,
and his eyes looked over the boy's head into the sky.
We have something important to do today. You may bring the bag for nuts if you wish. It does not matter. And anyway, we will be going into the woods.
Jess and David set out from the Bentley farmhouse in the old phaeton that was drawn by the white horse. When they had gone along in silence for a long way, they stopped at the edge of a field where a flock of sheep were gazing. Among the sheep was a lamb that had been born out of season, and this David and his grandfather caught and tied so tightly that it looked like a little white ball. When they drove on again, Jess let David hold the lamb in his arms.
I saw it yesterday, and it put me in mind of what I have long waited to do, he said,
and again he looked away over the head of the boy with the wavering, uncertain stare in his eyes. After the feeling of exaltation that had come to the farmer as a result of his successful year, another mood had taken possession of him. For a long time he had been going about feeling very humble and prayerful. Again he walked alone at night, thinking of God, and as he walked, he again connected his own figure with the figures of the old days. Under the stars he knelt on the wet grass and raised up his voice in prayer. Now he decided that, like the men whose stories filled the pages of the Bible, he would make a sacrifice to God.
I have been given these abundant crops, and God has also sent me a boy who is called David, he whispered to himself. Perhaps I should have done this thing long ago.
He was sorry the idea had not come into his mind in the days before his daughter Louise had been born, and thought that surely now, when he had erected a pile of burning sticks in some lonely place in the woods and had offered the body of the lamb as a burnt offering, God would appear to him and give him a message. More and more, as he thought of the matter, he thought also of David, and his passionate self-love was partially forgotten.
It is time for the boy to begin thinking of going out into the world, and the message will be one concerning him, he decided. God will make a pathway for him. He will tell me what place David is to take in life, and when he shall set out on his journey. It is right that the boy should be there. If I am fortunate, and an angel of God should appear, David will see the beauty and glory of God made manifest to man. It will make a true man of God of him also.
In silence, Jess and David drove along the road until they came to that place where Jess had once before appealed to God, and had frightened his grandson. The morning had been bright and cheerful, but a cold wind now began to blow, and clouds hid the sun. When David saw the place to which they had come, he began to tremble with fright. And when they stopped by the bridge where the creek came down from among the trees, he wanted to spring out of the phaeton and run away. A dozen plans for escape ran through David's head, but when Jess stopped the horse and climbed over the fence into the wood, he followed.
It is foolish to be afraid. Nothing will happen, he told himself as he went along with the lamb in his arms.
There was something in the helplessness of the little animal held so tightly in his arms that gave him courage. He could feel the rapid beating of the beast's heart, and that made his own heart beat less rapidly. As he walked swiftly along behind his grandfather, he untied the string with which the four legs of the lamb were fastened together.
If anything happens, we will run away together, he thought.
In the woods, after they had gone a long way from the road, Jess stopped in an opening among the trees where a clearing, overgrown with small bushes, ran up from the creek. He was still silent, but began at once to erect a heap of dry sticks, which he presently set afire. The boy sat on the ground with the lamb in his arms. His imagination began to invest every moment of the old man with significance, and he became every moment more afraid.
I must put the blood of the lamb on the head of the boy,
Jess muttered when the sticks had begun to blaze greedily, and taking a long knife from his pocket, he turned and walked rapidly across the clearing toward David. Terror seized upon the soul of the boy. He was sick with it,
For a moment he sat perfectly still, and then his body stiffened and he sprang to his feet. His face became as white as the fleece of the lamb that now, finding itself suddenly released, ran down the hill. David ran also. Fear made his feet fly. Over the low bushes and logs, he leaped frantically. As he ran, he put his hand into his pocket and took out the branched stick from which the sling for shooting squirrels was suspended. When he came to the creek that was shallow and splashed down over the stones, he dashed into the water and turned to look back. And when he saw his grandfather still running toward him with the long knife held tightly in his hand, he did not hesitate, but reaching down, selected a stone and put it in the sling. With all his strength, he drew back the heavy rubber bands, and the stone whistled through the air. It hit Jess, who had entirely forgotten the boy and was pursuing the lamb, squarely in the head. With a groan, he pitched forward and fell almost at the boy's feet. When David saw that he lay still and that he was apparently dead, his fright increased immeasurably. It became an insane panic. With a cry, he turned and ran off through the woods, weeping convulsively.
"I don't care. I killed him, but I don't care," he sobbed.
As he ran on and on, he decided suddenly that he would never go back again to the Bentley Farms or to the town of Winesburg.
"I have killed the man of God, and now I will myself be a man and go out into the world," he said stoutly as he stopped running and walked rapidly down a road that followed the windings of Wine Creek as it ran through fields and forests into the west. On the ground by the creek, Jess Bentley moved uneasily about. He groaned and opened his eyes. For a long time he lay perfectly still and looked at the sky. When at last he got to his feet, his mind was confused, and he was not surprised by the boy's disappearance. By the road, he sat down on a log and began to talk about God. That is all they ever got out of him. Whenever David's name was mentioned, he looked vaguely at the sky and said that a messenger from God had taken the boy.
"It happened because I was too greedy for glory," he declared, and would have no more to say in the matter.
A Man of Ideas, concerning Joe Welling. He lived with his mother, a gray, silent woman with a peculiar ashy complexion. The house in which they lived stood in a little grove of trees beyond where the main street of Winesburg crossed Wine Creek. His name was Joe Welling, and his father had been a man of some dignity in the community, a lawyer, and a member of the state legislature at Columbus. Joe himself was small of body, and in his character, unlike anyone else in town. He was like a tiny little volcano that lies silent for days and then suddenly spouts fire. No, he wasn't like that. He was like a man who is subject to fits, one who walks about his fellow men inspiring fear because a fit may come upon him suddenly and blow him away into a strange, uncanny physical state in which his eyes roll and his legs and arms jerk. He was like that, only that the visitation that descended upon Joe Welling was a mental and not a physical thing. He was beset by ideas, and in the throes of one of his ideas was uncontrollable. Words rolled and tumbled from his mouth. A peculiar smile came upon his lips. The edges of his teeth, that were tipped with gold, glistened in the light. Pouncing upon a bystander, he began to talk. For the bystander, there was no escape. The excited man breathed into his face, peered into his eyes, pounded on his chest with a shaky forefinger, demanded, compelled attention. In those days, the Standard Oil Company did not deliver oil to the consumer in big wagons and motor trucks as it does now, but delivered instead to retail grocers, hardware stores, and the like. Joe was a Standard Oil agent in Winesburg and in several towns up and down the railroad that went through Winesburg. He collected bills, booked orders, and did other things. His father, the legislator, had secured the job for him. In and out of the stores of Winesburg went Joe Welling, silent, excessively polite, intent upon his business.
Men watched him with eyes in which lurked amusement tempered by alarm. They were waiting for him to break forth, preparing to flee. Although the seizures that came upon him were harmless enough, they could not be laughed away. They were overwhelming. Astride an idea, Joe was overmastering. His personality became gigantic. It overrode the man to whom he talked, swept him away, swept all away, all who stood within the sound of his voice. In Sylvester West's drugstore stood four men who were talking of horse racing. Wellesley Moyer's stallion, Tony Tip, was to race at the June meeting in Tiffin, Ohio, and there was a rumor that he would meet the stiffest competition of his career. It was said that Pop Gears, the great racing driver, would himself be there. A doubt of the success of Tony Tip hung heavy in the air of Winesburg. Into the drugstore came Joe Welling, brushing the screen door violently aside. With a strange, absorbed light in his eye, he pounced upon Ed Thomas, he who knew Pop Gears, and whose opinion of Tony Tip's chances was worth considering. "The water is up in Wine Creek!" cried Joe Welling, with the air of Pheidippides, bringing news of the victory of the Greeks in the struggle at Marathon. His finger beat a tattoo upon Ed Thomas's broad chest. "By Trunion Bridge, it is within 11.5 inches of the flooring!" he went on, the words coming quickly, with a little whistling noise from beneath his teeth. An expression of helpless annoyance crept over the faces of the four. "I have my facts correct. Depend upon that. I went to Sinning's hardware store and got a ruler. Then I went back and measured. I could hardly believe my own eyes. It hadn't rained, you see, for 10 days. At first I didn't know what to think. Thoughts rushed through my head. I thought of subterranean passages and springs. Down under the ground went my mind, delving about. I sat at the floor of the bridge and rubbed my head. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. Not one. Come out into the streets and you'll see. There wasn't a cloud. There isn't a cloud now. Oh, yes, there was a cloud. I don't want to keep back any facts. There was a cloud in the west, down near the horizon. A cloud no bigger than a man's hand. Not that I think that has anything to do with it. There it is, you see. You understand how puzzled I was. Then an idea came to me. I laughed. You'll laugh, too. Of course, it rained over in Medina County. That's interesting, eh? If we had no trains, no mails, no telegraph, we would know that it rained over in Medina County. That's where Wine Creek comes from. Everyone knows that. Little old Wine Creek brought us the news. That's interesting. I laughed. I thought I'd tell you. It's interesting, eh? Joe Welling turned and went out the door. Taking a book from his pocket, he stopped and ran a finger down one of the pages. Again, he was absorbed in his duties as agent of the Standard Oil Company. "Hearn's Grocery will be getting low on coal oil. I'll see them," he muttered, hurrying along the street and bowing politely to the right and left at the people walking past. When George Willard went to work for the Winesburg Eagle, he was besieged by Joe Welling. Joe envied the boy. It seemed to him that he was meant by nature to be a reporter on a newspaper. "It is what I should be doing, there's no doubt of that," he declared, stopping George Willard on the sidewalk before Doherty's feed store. His eyes began to glisten and his forefinger to tremble. "Of course, I make more money with the Standard Oil Company, and I'm only telling you," he added. "I've got nothing against you, but I should have your place. I could do the work at odd moments. Here and there I would run finding out things you'll never see." Becoming more excited, Joe Welling crowded the young reporter against the front of the feed store. He appeared to be lost in thought, rolling his eyes about and running a thin, nervous hand through his hair. A smile spread over his face, and his gold teeth glittered. "You get out your notebook," he commanded. "You carry a little pad of paper in your pocket, don't you? I knew you did. Well, you set this down. I thought of it the other day. Let's take decay. Now, what is decay? It's fire. It burns up wood and other things. You never thought of that? Of course not. This sidewalk here and this feed store, the trees down the street there, they're all on fire. They're burning up. Decay, you see, is always going on. It doesn't stop. Water and paint can't stop it. If a thing is iron, then what? It rusts, you see. That's fire, too. The world is on fire. Start your piece in the paper that way. Just say, in big letters, 'The world is on fire.'"
That will make him look up. They'll say you're a smart one. I don't care. I don't envy you. I just snatched that idea out of the air. I would make a newspaper hum. You gotta admit that. Turning quickly, Joe Welling walked rapidly away. When he had taken several steps, he stopped and looked back. I'm going to stick to you, he said. I'm going to make you a regular hummer. I should start a newspaper myself. That's what I should do. I'd be a marvel. Everybody knows that. When George Willard had been for a year on the Winesburg Eagle, four things happened to Joe Welling. His mother died. He came to live at the new Willard house. He became involved in a love affair. And he organized the Winesburg Baseball Club. Joe organized the baseball club because he wanted to be a coach, and in that position he began to win the respect of his townsmen.
He is a wonder,
they declared, after Joe's team had whipped the team from Medina County.
He gets everybody working together. You just watch him.
Upon the baseball field, Joe Welling stood by first base, his whole body quivering with excitement. In spite of themselves, all the players watched him closely. The opposing pitcher became confused.
Now, 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 shouted the excited man. Watch me, watch me, watch my fingers, watch my hands, watch my feet, watch my eyes. Let's work together here, watch me. In me, you see all the movements of the game. Work with me, watch me, watch me, watch me.
With runners of the Winesburg team on bases, Joe Welling became as one inspired. Before they knew what had come over them, the base runners were watching the man, edging off bases, advancing, retreating, held as by an invisible cord. The players of the opposite team also watched Joe. They were fascinated. For a moment they watched, and then, as though to break a spell that hung over them, they began hurling the ball wildly about, and, amid a series of fierce, animal-like cries from the coach, the runners of the Winesburg team scampered home. Joe Welling's love affair set the town of Winesburg on edge. When it began, everyone whispered and shook his head. When people tried to laugh, the laughter was forced and unnatural. Joe fell in love with Sarah King, a lean, sad-looking woman who lived with her father and brother in a brick house that stood opposite the gate leading to the Winesburg Cemetery. The two Kings, Edward the father and Tom the son, were not popular in Winesburg. They were called proud and dangerous. They had come to Winesburg from some place in the south and ran a cider mill on the Trunnion Pike. Tom King was reported to have killed a man before he came to Winesburg. He was 27 years old and rode about town on a gray pony. Also, he had a long yellow mustache that dropped down over his teeth and always carried a heavy, wicked-looking walking stick in his hand. Once, he killed a dog with the stick. The dog belonged to Win Pawsey, the shoe merchant, and stood on the sidewalk wagging its tail. Tom King killed it with one blow. He was arrested and paid a fine of $10. Old Edward King was small of stature, and when he passed people in the street, laughed a queer, unmirthful laugh. When he laughed, he scratched his left elbow with his right hand. The sleeve of his coat was almost worn through from the habit. As he walked along the street, looking nervously about and laughing, he seemed more dangerous than his silent, fierce-looking son. When Sarah King began walking out in the evening with Joe Welling, people shook their heads in alarm. She was tall and pale and had dark rings under her eyes. The couple looked ridiculous together. Under the trees they walked, and Joe talked. His passionate, eager protestations of love, heard coming out of the darkness of the cemetery wall, or from the deep shadows of the trees on the hill that ran up to the fairgrounds from Waterworks Pond, were repeated in the stores. Men stood by the bar in the new Willard house, laughing and talking of Joe's courtship. After the laughter came the silence. The Winesburg baseball team, under his management, was winning game after game, and the town had begun to respect him. Sensing a tragedy, they waited, laughing nervously. Late on a Saturday afternoon, the meeting between Joe Welling and the two Kings, the anticipation of which had set the town on edge,
took place in Joe Welling's room in the New Willard House. George Willard was a witness to the meeting. It came about in this way. When a young reporter went to his room after the evening meal, he saw Tom King and his father sitting in the half-darkness in Joe's room. The son had the heavy walking stick in his hand and sat near the door. Old Edward King walked nervously about, scratching his left elbow with his right hand. The hallways were empty and silent. George Willard went to his own room and sat down at his desk. He tried to write, but his hand trembled so that he could not hold the pen. He also walked nervously up and down. Like the rest of the town of Winesburg, he was perplexed and knew not what to do. It was 7:30 and fast growing dark when Joe Welling came along the station platform toward the New Willard House. In his arms, he held a bundle of weeds and grasses. In spite of the terror that made his body shake, George Willard was amused at the sight of the small, spry figure holding the grasses and half running along the platform. Shaking with fright and anxiety, the young reporter lurked in the hallway outside the door of the room in which Joe Welling talked to the two Kings. There had been an oath, the nervous giggle of old Edward King, and then silence. Now, the voice of Joe Welling, sharp and clear, broke forth. George Willard began to laugh. He understood. As he had swept all men before him, so now Joe Welling was carrying the two men in the room off their feet with a tidal wave of words. The listener in the hall walked up and down, lost in amazement. Inside the room, Joe Welling had paid no attention to the grumbling threat of Tom King. Absorbed in an idea, he closed the door and, lighting a lamp, spread a full handful of weeds and grass upon the floor. "I've got something here," he announced solemnly. "I was going to tell George Willard about it, let him make a piece out of it for the paper. I'm glad you're here. I wish Sarah were here also. I've been going to come to your house and tell you some of my ideas. They're interesting. Sarah wouldn't let me. She said we'd quarrel. That's foolish." Running up and down before the two perplexed men, Joe Welling began to explain. "Don't you make a mistake now," he cried. "This is something big." His voice was shrill with excitement. "You just follow me. You'll be interested. I know you will. Suppose this. Suppose all of the wheat, the corn, the oats, the peas, the potatoes were all by some miracle swept away. Now here we are, you see, in this county. There is a high fence built all around us. We'll suppose that. No one can get over the fence, and all the fruits of the earth are destroyed. Nothing left but these wild things, these grasses. Would we be done for? I ask you that. Would we be done for?" Again, Tom King growled, and for a moment there was silence in the room. Then again, Joe plunged into the exposition of his idea. "Things would go hard for a time, I admit that. I've got to admit that. No getting around it. We'd be hard put to it. More than one fat stomach would cave in. But they couldn't down us. I should say not." Tom King laughed good-naturedly, and the shivery, nervous laugh of Edward King rang through the house. Joe Welling hurried on. "We'll begin, you see, to breed up new vegetables and fruits. Soon we'd regain all we had lost. Mind, I don't say the new things will be the same as the old. They wouldn't. Or maybe they'd be better. Maybe not so good. That's interesting, eh? You can think about that. It starts your mind working now, don't it?" In the room, there was silence, and then again old Edward King laughed nervously. "Say, I wish Sarah was here," cried Joe Welling. "Let's go up to your house. I want to tell her of this." There was a scraping of chairs in the room. It was then that George Willard retreated to his own room. Leaning out at the window, he saw Joe Welling going along the street with the two Kings. Tom King was forced to take extraordinary long strides to keep pace with the little man. As he strode along, he leaned over, listening, absorbed, fascinated. Joe Welling again talked excitedly. "Take milkweed now," he cried. "A lot might be done with milkweed, eh? It's almost unbelievable. I want you to think about it. I want you two to think about it. There would be a new vegetable kingdom, you see. It's interesting, eh? It's an idea. Wait till you see Sarah. She'll get the idea. She'll be interested.
Sarah is always interested in ideas. You can't be too smart for Sarah, now can you? Of course you can't. You know that.
Adventure Concerning Alice Hindman. Alice Hindman, a woman of 27 when George Willard was a mere boy, had lived in Winesburg all her life. She clerked in Winnie's dry goods store and lived with her mother, who had married a second husband. Alice's stepfather was a carriage painter and given to drink. His story is an odd one. It will be worth telling someday. At 27, Alice was tall and somewhat slight. Her head was large and overshadowed her body. Her shoulders were a little stooped, and her hair and eyes brown. She was very quiet, but beneath a placid exterior, a continual ferment went on. When she was a girl of 16, and before she began to work in the store, Alice had an affair with a young man. The young man, named Ned Curry, was older than Alice. He, like George Willard, was employed on the Winesburg Eagle, and for a time he went to see Alice almost every evening. Together, the two of them walked under the trees through the streets of the town and talked of what they would do with their lives. Alice was then a very pretty girl, and Ned took her into his arms and kissed her. He became excited and said things he did not intend to say, and Alice, betrayed by her desire to have something beautiful come into her rather narrow life, also grew excited. She also talked. The outer crust of her life, all of her natural diffidence and reserve, was torn away, and she gave herself over to the emotions of love. When, late in the fall of her 16th year, Ned Curry went away to Cleveland, where he hoped to get a place on a city newspaper and rise in the world, she wanted to go with him. With a trembling voice, she told him what was in her mind. "I will work, and you can work," she said. "I do not want to harness you to a needless expense that will prevent you from making progress. Don't marry me now. We will get along without that, and we can be together. Even though we live in the same house, no one will say anything. In the city, we will be unknown, and people will pay no attention to us." Ned Curry was puzzled by the determination and abandon of his sweetheart, and was also deeply touched. He had wanted the girl to become his mistress, but changed his mind. He wanted to protect and care for her.
"You don't know what you're talking about," he said sharply. "You may be sure I'll let you do no such thing. As soon as I get a good job, I'll come back. For the present, you have to stay here. It's the only thing we can do."
On the evening before he left Winesburg to take up his new life in the city, Ned Curry went to call on Alice. They walked about through the trees for an hour, and then got a rig from Wellesley Moyer's livery and went for a drive in the country. The moon came up, and they found themselves unable to talk. In his sadness, the young man forgot the resolutions he had made regarding his conduct with the girl. They got out of the buggy at a place where a long meadow ran down to the bank of Wine Creek, and there, in the dim light, became lovers. When, at midnight, they returned to town, they were both glad. It did not seem to them that anything that could happen in the future could blot out the wonder and beauty of the thing that had happened.
"Now we will have to stick to each other. Whatever happens, we will have to do that,"
Ned Curry said as he left the girl at her father's door. The young newspaper man did not succeed in getting a place on a Cleveland paper and went west to Chicago. For a time, he was lonely and wrote to Alice almost every day. Then he was caught up by the life of the city. He began to make friends and found new interests in life. In Chicago, he boarded at a house where there were several women. One of them attracted his attention, and he forgot Alice in Winesburg. At the end of a year, he stopped writing letters, and only once in a long time, when he was lonely or when he went into one of the city parks and saw the moon shining on the grass as it had shone that night on the meadow by Wine Creek, did he think of her at all. In Winesburg, the girl who had been loved grew to be a woman. When she was 22 years old, her father, who owned a harness repair shop, died suddenly. The harness maker was an old soldier, and after a few months, his wife received a widow's pension. She used the first money she got to buy a loom and became a weaver of carpets, and Alice got a place in Winnie's store. For a number of years, nothing could have induced her to believe that Ned Currie would not, in the end, return to her. She was glad to be employed, because the daily round of toil in the store made the time of waiting seem less long and uninteresting. She began to save money, thinking that when she had saved $200 or $300, she would follow her lover to the city and try if her presence would not win back his affections. Alice did not blame Ned Currie for what had happened in the moonlight and the field, but felt that she could never marry another man. To her, the thought of giving to another what she still felt could belong only to Ned seemed monstrous. When other young men tried to attract her attention, she would have nothing to do with them. "I am his wife, and shall remain his wife, whether he comes back or not," she whispered to herself, and for all of her willingness to support herself, could not have understood the growing modern idea of a woman's owning herself and giving and taking for her own ends in life. Alice worked in the dry goods store from 8 in the morning until 6 at night, and on 3 evenings a week went back to the store to stay from 7 until 9. As time passed, and she became more and more lonely, she began to practice the devices common to lonely people. When at night she went upstairs into her own room, she knelt on the floor to pray, and in her prayers whispered things she wanted to say to her lover. She became attached to inanimate objects, and because it was her own, could not bear to have anyone touch the furniture of her room. The trick of saving money, begun for a purpose, was carried on after the scheme of going to the city to find Ned Currie had been given up. It became a fixed habit, and when she needed new clothes, she did not get them. Sometimes, on rainy afternoons in the store, she got out her bankbook, and letting it lie open before her, spent hours dreaming impossible dreams of saving enough money so that the interest would support both herself and her future husband. "Ned always liked to travel about," she thought. "I'll give him the chance. Some day, when we are married, and I can save both his money and my own, we will be rich. Then we can travel together all over the world." In the dry goods store, weeks ran into months and months into years, as Alice waited and dreamed of her lover's return. Her employer, a gray old man with false teeth and a thin gray mustache that dropped down over his mouth, was not given to conversation, and sometimes on rainy days and in the winter, when a storm raged in Main Street, long hours passed when no customers came in. Alice arranged and rearranged the stock. She stood near the front window where she could look down the deserted street and thought of the evenings when she had walked with Ned Currie and of what he had said. "We will have to stick to each other now." The words echoed and re-echoed through the mind of the maturing woman. Tears came into her eyes. Sometimes, when her employer had gone out and she was alone in the store, she put her head on the counter and wept.
"Oh, Ned, I am waiting," she whispered over and over,
and all the time the creeping fear that he would never come back grew stronger within her. In the spring, when the rains have passed and before the long hot days of summer have come, the country about Winesburg is delightful. The town lies in the midst of open fields, but beyond the fields are pleasant patches of woodlands. In the wooded places are many little cloistered nooks, quiet places where lovers go to sit on Sunday afternoons. Through the trees they look out across the fields and see farmers at work about the barns, or people driving up and down on the roads. In the town, bells ring, and occasionally a train passes, looking like a toy thing in the distance. For several years after Ned Currie went away, Alice did not go into the wood with the other young people on Sunday. But one day, After he had been gone for 2 or 3 years, and when her loneliness seemed unbearable, she put on her best dress and set out. Finding a little sheltered place from which she could see the town and a long stretch of the fields, she sat down. Fear of age and ineffectuality took possession of her. She could not sit still, and arose. As she stood looking out over the land, something, perhaps the thought of never-ceasing life as it expresses itself in the flow of the seasons, fixed her mind on the passing years. With a shiver of dread, she realized that for her, the beauty and freshness of youth had passed. For the first time, she felt that she had been cheated. She did not blame Ned Currie, and did not know what to blame. Sadness swept over her. Dropping to her knees, she tried to pray, but instead of prayers, words of protest came to her lips.
"It's not going to come to me. I will never find happiness. Why do I tell myself lies?"
She cried, and an odd sense of relief came with this, her first bold attempt to face the fear that had become a part of her everyday life. In the year when Alice Hindman became 25, two things happened to disturb the dull uneventfulness of her days. Her mother married Bush Milton, the carriage painter of Winesburg, and she herself became a member of the Winesburg Methodist Church. Alice joined the church because she had become frightened of the loneliness of her position in life. Her mother's second marriage had emphasized her isolation.
"I am becoming old and queer. If Ned comes, he will not want me. In the city where he is living, men are perpetually young. There is so much going on that they do not have time to grow old,"
she told herself with a grim little smile, and went resolutely about the business of becoming acquainted with people. Every Thursday evening when the store closed, she went to a prayer meeting in the basement of the church, and on Sunday evening attended a meeting of an organization called the Epworth League. When Will Hurley, a middle-aged man who clerked in a drugstore and who also belonged to the church, offered to walk home with her, she did not protest.
"Of course, I will not let him make a practice of being with me, but if he comes to see me once in a long time, there can be no harm in that,"
she told herself, still determined in her loyalty to Ned Currie. Without realizing what was happening, Alice was trying feebly at first, but with growing determination, to get a new hold upon life. Beside the drug clerk, she walked in silence. But sometimes, in the darkness, as they went stolidly along, she put out her hand and touched softly the folds of his coat. When he left her at the gate before her mother's house, she did not go indoors, but stood for a moment by the door. She wanted to call to the drug clerk, to ask him to sit with her in the darkness on the porch before the house, but was afraid he would not understand.
"It's not him that I want," she told herself. "I want to avoid being so much alone. If I am not careful, I will grow unaccustomed to being with people."
During the early fall of her 27th year, a passionate restlessness took possession of Alice. She could not bear to be in the company of the drug clerk, and when in the evening he came to walk with her, she sent him away. Her mind became intensely active, and when weary from the long hours of standing behind the counter in the store, she went home and crawled into bed. She could not sleep. With staring eyes, she looked into the darkness. Her imagination, like a child awakening from long sleep, played about the room. Deep within her, there was something that could not be cheated by fantasies, and that demanded some definite answer from life. Alice took a pillow into her arms and held it tightly against her breasts. Getting out of bed, she arranged a blanket so that in the darkness it looked like a form lying between the sheets, and kneeling beside the bed, she caressed it, whispering words over and over like a refrain.
"Why doesn't something happen? Why am I left here alone?"
she mutters. Although she sometimes thought of Ned Currie, she no longer depended on him. Her desire had grown vague. She did not want Ned Currie or any other man. She wanted to be loved,
to have something answer the call that was growing louder and louder within her. And then one night when it rained, Alice had an adventure. It frightened and confused her. She had come home from the store at 9 and found the house empty. Bush Milton had gone off to town and her mother to the house of a neighbor. Alice went upstairs to her room and undressed in the darkness. For a moment, she stood by the window, hearing the rain beat against the glass, and then a strange desire took possession of her. Without stopping to think of what she intended to do, she ran downstairs through the dark house and out into the rain. As she stood on the little grass plot before the house and felt the cold rain on her body, a mad desire to run naked through the streets took possession of her. She thought that the rain would have some creative and wonderful effect on her body. Not for years had she felt so full of youth and courage. She wanted to leap and run, to cry out, to find some other lonely human and embrace him. On the brick sidewalk before the house, a man stumbled homeward. Alice started to run. A wild, desperate mood took possession of her. "What do I care who it is? He is lonely, and I will go to him," she thought. And then, without stopping to consider the possible result of her madness, called softly. "Wait," she cried. "Don't go away. Whoever you are, you must wait." The man on the sidewalk stopped and stood listening. He was an old man and somewhat deaf. Putting his hand to his mouth, he shouted,
"What? What say?"
he called. Alice dropped to the ground and lay trembling. She was so frightened at the thought of what she had done that when the man had gone on his way, she did not dare get to her feet, but crawled on hands and knees through the grass to the house. When she got to her own room, she bolted the door and drew her dressing table across the doorway. Her body shook as with a chill, and her hands trembled so that she had difficulty getting into her nightdress. When she got into bed, she buried her face in the pillow and wept brokenheartedly. "What's the matter with me? I will do something dreadful if I'm not careful," she thought, and turning her face to the wall, began trying to force herself to face bravely the fact that many people must live and die alone, even in Winesburg. And those are our stories for this evening. I hope you enjoyed Godliness Part 4, A Man with Ideas, and Adventure. From Winesburg, Ohio, by Sherwood Anderson. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.